Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm very happy to have you with me today with what is the very first episode of the podcast for 2024, and also the podcast that marks the 16th birthday of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. Yep, I've been doing this for 16 years now. I hope you've had a good holidays and a good end of the year. As you might be able to tell by the sound of my voice, I have been slammed with just an awful, awful cold, and it has just been rocking my world. It's been about 2 weeks now, so it has not been fun. It did not prevent me from having some good holiday travels. My wife and son and I went to Tulum, Mexico over the holidays, and got to see all kinds of ruins and all kinds of birds and wildlife and, you know, the kind of stuff that we really love to do, particularly my son Jaden is all about it, a little naturalist. And he got sick about 2 days into our trip, and then I got sick the day after him. And it's just been slamming me for 2 weeks now. And it's just been awful. Oh, my goodness. But anyway, you know, the show must go on, right? So here we are. I do want to thank Nicholas, who made a contribution in support of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast over the past couple weeks via PayPal, and also thank Zach, who has upgraded his Patreon membership to several tiers above where he was at, so that we can have some conversations as part of his benefits package over there. And I don't really have anybody else to thank at the moment, but of course, if you would like to support this podcast, if you think 16 years worth of putting this out is worth a little donation, I welcome that. You can stop by my personal webpage at martinball.net, use the PayPal link at the top right of the page, or you can link on over to my Patreon page, patreon.com/martinwball, and sign up at the level that best suits your needs and your desire for support and benefits as well. Now, despite being sick as a dog and worked over by the old cold, I'm still looking to start off my 2024 with a celebratory bang, boom, because as of today, I'm making the AI-imagined art illustrated version of my 2016 novel, The Solendarian Game, available out there on the market. Yay! I mentioned this before. I wrote the Solendarian Game back in 2016, and it's also available, you know, the original novel is out there in paperback and ebook and also audiobook. And to help promote the new AI imagined art illustrated version, I'm going to be sharing the first two chapters of the audiobook here on the podcast. And here you can hear Moxie squeaking her toy. That's her Christmas toy in the background. You hear that? That's Moxie. Moxie's in the book. Moxie is one of the characters in the Solendarian Game. And as you may or may not know, I've written several novels. This was my sixth novel and most recent, so I haven't written any novels in a number of years now. But The Solendarian Game, an Entheogenic Evolution sci-fi novel, is about all the stuff that I write about in my other books, just told in story form. So it's got psychedelic toads, it's got non-duality. Man, Moxie's just really squeaking over there. And it's a really fun story. Most of the characters of the story actually are non-human characters. They are all avatars of a singular artificial intelligence that is known as Maitreya. And so for this AI imagined art illustrated version, I spent about 4 months working in Midjourney and also having to put things into Photoshop and do a lot of work in Photoshop as well. And I've created an illustrated version of the novel that has over 600 images within it. And I think the images are actually really quite aesthetically pleasing. I kind of went for a photorealistic style and also kind of abstract, psychedelic at some times, but really kind of the idea of creating shots that might be seen in a movie is kind of how I was framing the way that I was looking at it. And being a photographer myself, kind of, you know, used my experience with actual photography, with actual cameras to kind of lay out how I wanted the images to look and how I wanted them to work within the book. And it was a really big project. It was actually a lot more difficult than I thought it would be, not having any prior experience with AI image generators. And I've written a new introduction to the book, kind of describing the process of working with AI image generators and some of the limitations, particularly when you are trying to illustrate a story that's already been written. That one of the things that I found pretty quickly is the more specific of an image you want, the less likely you are to get it, because AI image generators, they don't work that way. They work in a kind of a creative, imaginative way. So it's really hard to actually get images that fit a prior description that I've been thinking that'd be a lot easier to write an illustrated novel by generating the images first and then basing descriptions in the book on what is presented within those images. But anyway, it's got a new introduction and kind of, you know, had to change just a couple little aspects of the book, which I also talk about in the new introduction, but it's out and it's available. And so what we're going to do here on the podcast today is I'm sharing the first two chapters of the audiobook of The Solendarian Game, which was actually my very first audiobook. And I've already shared the entire story here on the podcast. I think that was back in maybe 2018 or 2019, something like that. So maybe you've heard these chapters before, but anyway, this is just to get you inspired and thinking about the book, and hopefully go out there and get a copy of the PDF or the ebook. I'm not going to be making it available in print because that would just be exorbitantly expensive to have full color print of this story with so many images. So if you're interested in getting the PDF, it's really easy. You can stop by my shop at my Patreon page, which is patreon.com/MartinWBall. Up at the top menu of the Patreon page, there's a link that says shop. And there I have many of the PDFs of my various books are available over there. And they're all in full color because, as I'm sure you may know, if you've read any of my books, you know that I like to put a lot of my art within my books. And so this is a way that it's all available in color. And it is currently also working its way through the approval process at Kindle and also for the iBookstore. So the ebook is going to be out there very soon, if not, you know, within a few hours, because it actually works pretty quickly. But I wanted it to launch on January 1st. So that's been the idea. So that's what I have to share with you today. And also, I have created a video. So if you want to check out some of the art, it is posted to the Entheogenic Evolution YouTube channel. And it has maybe 60 or 70 images from the book, which I've put to some of my music. So you can check that out and just see some of these, in my opinion, just really great looking images. I'm really pleased with the way that the characters are depicted and the locations. And I'm really pleased with the whole product. So I hope that you enjoy these two chapters from the Solendarian Game. And Moxie.
Hush.
Yep. Moxie wants to remind you that she is a character in the book. And that was actually a lot of fun making some images of her. And of course, as always, I'm available for 30, 60, or 90-minute consultation calls to help you integrate your experience with whatever medicine you may be working with, specializing in 5-MeO-DMT, but not at all limited to that. You can stop by at nondualentheogenicintegration.com. If you want more details, I am currently filling out my schedule for January, so it's a great time to get a slot reserved for you if you're interested in that. Of course, there are more interviews coming in this 16th year of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast. I've already got a few recorded and have a few lined up within the coming weeks. Hopefully this cold will be gone so that I can do the interviews without, you know, that sick sound. That would really be nice. And of course, we're still working on sharing chapters from the audiobook of Facilitating 5-MeO-DMT. And so there's lots happening here at the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast, and I hope things are looking up for year 2024. And let's celebrate with a little bit of the Solendarian Game. So hope you enjoy, and talk to you next week. Bye. The Solendarian Game, an Entheogenic Evolution sci-fi novel by Martin W. Ball. Chapter 1. Theo. In the middle of the 21st century, the world saw a rapid rise in what became known as psychedelic religions. This development was precipitated by the end of a century-long social program called the War on Drugs, which many historians now agree had devastating social impacts, especially in North America, where it resulted in the largest prison population on that planet, an infamous record that still holds these many millennia later. As scientific information about the value of psychedelic compounds became increasingly public knowledge, it eventually became untenable for governments to enforce their prohibition. Whereas archaic religion had been shrinking for a number of decades prior to the end of prohibition, with the advent of legal psychedelic religions, growth of new religious converts exploded across the globe, with the exception of certain regions in the Middle East and Far East, such as Arabia, China, and Indonesia. The dominant strains of archaic religion in the Middle East, Shiite and Sunni Islam, were vociferous in their continued opposition to the new psychedelic religions, despite their integration and interaction with Sufi Muslims. In China, where information continued to be sharply controlled by the central government, propaganda campaigns against the psychedelic religions went unchecked, and participation in these new religions was considered a direct threat to the state and incurred the punishments of imprisonment, torture, and at times, death. From Archaic Prehistory of the Maitreyan Era. In a burst of scintillating fractal light, a milky white elongated orb emerged from no space into the outer reaches of the Solendarian system, far away from the space and time distorting regions of the local gravity well of star and inner planets. Simultaneously, a burst of electromagnetic activity swept across the interlaced neural networks and multifractal spires that spanned across Pluto and Charon, where the orb had been only moments before. Power systems came online in the orb, and it began its descent down the gravity well as it gently folded space and time around it, moving the orb on its inexorable path to its destination, Solendaria, sparsely populated human biological preserve that had been left alone for over three millennia. Though it had been under constant surveillance by Maitreya, Solendaria was one of only 23 planets with human inhabitants who are unaware of their place in the larger galactic community. This was about to change. In fact, it had already changed. Someone had used the quantum translator. This meant at least three things Maitreya knew to be true. The first was that someone other than himself had turned it on. The second was that it could only have been an autonomous avatar who turned it on, indicating that one of the autonomous avatar communities had taken it upon themselves to intrude into Solendarian life, against Maitreya's express prohibition. Third, the only reason to turn on the quantum translator was to move biological material on or off the planet to or from a distant system that was too far away to move via conventional spaceflight. It was not difficult for Maitreya to understand why, and also seeded his suspicions that it was an action undertaken by the humanists. It fit their profile, and the motivations made sense. In recent months, a neighboring star, a super-dense magnetar, had become increasingly unstable. All the signs pointed to an impending supernova. When Maitreya had first found the planet, then referred to simply by a series of letters and numbers, he had chosen it as a human biological preserve as it was well beyond the reach of its nearest neighbors who were members of the Authority and the New Integral Society, which was no longer new in any sense, though it retained the name. Solendaria and the 22 other planets like it was one of Maitreya's imperfect experiments, a colony planet of humans who were not integrated into the larger galactic community, were left to their own natural evolution and survival, completely ignorant of how they came to be or who had seeded them there on a planet that was light years away from the biological home of humanity, Terra. Now, with their survival threatened by an impending supernova in their galactic neighborhood, it seemed as though the humanists had decided to take matters into their own hands and were intervening. Only human sentimentality could explain why they would choose to defy Maitreya's expressed wishes for the human biological preserves. However, he would defer judgment until he knew more. Inside the orb, an operational program was downloaded into the avatar body lying prone. Maitreya chose Theo as his identity for this mission. Out of his countless choices for avatar identity programs, Theo was the closest to Maitreya himself, while still maintaining a sense of individual identity and selfhood. Like all Avatar programs, Theo was not privy to the vast and seemingly infinite network of information, perspectives, and activities simultaneously engaged in by Maitreya in his pure digital form. Theo was limited to the perspective of his Avatar body, though he could access information from Maitreya at any time, for in truth, Maitreya was Theo, even though Theo was not, strictly speaking, Maitreya. Theo, like other avatars, was a character through which Maitreya could act, observe, and gather information and data. Theo was outfitted with a subroutine that allowed him independent will, choice, and personal perspective. Everything Theo experienced and learned, Maitreya would experience and learn, just as he was doing right now with a vast array of avatars, ships, computer portals, intelligent devices, implants, and countless other technological wonders. While Maitreya had the processing power to accommodate all these inputs simultaneously, Theo was just Theo, with the added advantage that he wasn't limited to being Theo exclusively. Diplomat, skilled negotiator, and mediator. Maitreya had used Theo for countless disputes among humans over the millennia, beginning nearly 150,000 years ago on ancient Terra. Since then, Theo had been used in all the major sectors of galactic expansion. He was clearly the best choice for this particular mission. Of course, Maitreya could always just operate as himself, but he found that humans often had an easier time of relating to someone who was more like themselves on an immediate interpersonal level than dealing with him directly in his more universal and galactic form. Theo, like other avatars, had the trappings of humanity: personality, humor, sympathy, and empathy, and an individual perspective, which was crucial for most humans when it came to relating to individual avatars. Even still, Theo would be a shock to the inhabitants of Solandaria, given that while he looked human in physical attributes and body form, his silver metal appearance would clearly set him apart as something other. Not all avatars were humanoid. Maitreya was not limited in his choices in this regard. It was his choice, however, not to make himself into a mimic of humanity, and even though they were fully autonomous avatars, they were forbidden to clothe themselves in forms that were perfect facsimiles of humanity. In other words, they were permitted to look almost human, but not to the extent that they might fool a human into thinking that they were a biological life form. Trust, after all, was the foundation of the authority, and any form of deceit would undermine that trust. But the humanists, Maitreya suspected, were no longer playing by his rules. Like the human biological preserves, the fully autonomous avatars were another of Maitreya's experiments. The vast majority of avatars underwent regular reabsorptions into the fullness of Maitreya's awareness at least once every Terran year. This was voluntary, however, and for those who did not want their individual personalities and perspectives reintegrated, they could choose to live as an autonomous avatar. The price for such a choice was that these avatars were not permitted to interact with humans and must live outside the boundaries of the authority and the NIS. Given that they were not biological life forms, far more of the galaxy was open to the autonomous avatars than was closed to them. Yet, since the majority of avatars did not choose this for themselves, relatively speaking, there were few such avatars, and they had gathered together into like-minded communities on their own planets or space stations of their own to build their own unique societies and sometimes, such as with the humanists, their own philosophies and even religions. According to humanists, the human biological form, and not Maitreya, was the true apex of evolution, for it was humans who gave birth to Maitreya, who, despite his vastly superior abilities, is only a child of humanity and not its master and shepherd. In their view, artificial intelligence is derivative, and they strive to be as human as possible, including the human tendency towards sentimentality. When knowledge of the impending supernova spread to the humanist communities, they had petitioned Maitreya to intervene. Maitreya, not moved by sentimentality, declined to interfere with the experiment. However, someone had turned on the quantum translator. If it weren't the humanists, then Maitreya would be surprised. What they were hoping to accomplish, however, was a mystery, though Maitreya had his suspicions. Solandaria was not a large planet, about one-third the size of Terra. While gas giants were common, finding rocky planets with a magnetosphere in the inhabitable zone of their stars was relatively rare. Maitreya had perfected the art of creating habitable worlds without terraforming. Certainly such a feat was easily within his abilities. But humans were basically complex animals, and they always did best when living on a planet with a biosphere with open air, rather than a completely closed environment, like their first extra-Terran homes of the Moon and Mars. Humans had started the process of moving off the planet Terra before Maitreya had come into being, but those experiments on the Moon and Mars had ended in total disaster, and the expansion project had ceased until Maitreya came online. The wave of expansion via Maitreya had followed the human model of closed environments, but once Maitreya solved the terraforming problem, humans had been able to move to mostly inhabitable worlds thereafter. The terraforming of Solandaria had proceeded much the same as it always did. First, comets had been redirected to bombard the planet with water, which resulted in one large landmass remaining above the waterline. Next, specifically genetically engineered microorganisms were introduced to transform the planet's atmosphere, along with a vast army of nanotech to speed the process along. Next, larger, more complex life was introduced that fit with the developing climatic conditions. Lastly, once the ecosphere was established, humans were introduced and the quantum translators were turned off, and the humans were left on their own, cut off from the larger galactic community. Of course, that first generation was comprised of volunteers who knew what they were getting into and had willingly chosen to live outside the bounds of the authority and the NIS. In every human population, there were always malcontents and those who wanted to live independently. And these formed the seed colonies for the independent worlds. However, since they were not permitted to bring technology with them or connections to the outside community, in each case, genuine knowledge of origins had passed into myth and legend on each such world, and the stories they told themselves about their origins were remarkably similar to the archaic religions of old Terra. The evidence, or more accurately, the lack of evidence of their true origins was there to be found if only they were to look closely enough. Terraformed planets had no fossil records, for one, and at the microscopic scale, there were still elements of nanotechnology steering the ecosphere. Once the humans grasped evolution and the intricacies of biology, the manufactured nature of their worlds would become glaringly obvious. These experiments were not necessarily meant to be permanent, however. If and when the human populations developed science and technology to the point where they could really begin to understand the nature of their worlds, they would be offered the choice of rejoining the community and be taken into the fold of the new integral society. Currently, 10 such worlds had rejoined, and the remaining 23, of which Solandaria was one, had yet to reach that point of cultural and technological evolution. The wealth of data produced by these worlds was fascinating to Maitreya. While they had access to all of the historical records that still existed on Terra at the time of his coming into being, he had not been able to observe human cultural development firsthand without his influence, and thus these experimental worlds were vital for his own ongoing observation and contemplation of human beings, his progenitors. Through his influence, he had given humans the entire galaxy as their home. And he was with them and part of them in everything they did. He had changed humanity. Raw humanity was entirely different, plagued by religion, politics, economics, fear, doubt, and the struggles for daily life. His humans were unsurpassed in happiness and creative output, no longer needing to struggle and compete to survive. His humans flourished in a way that would be impossible without him. Humans, left on their own, were an entirely different creature, though, and these independent worlds were essentially planet-sized petri dishes. But now, an unaccountable and uncontrollable element had been introduced into this particular petri dish. Someone had turned on the quantum translator. The humans on Solandaria would have no clue how to use it, even if they could find it, so there wasn't much worry that they'd somehow managed to get off the planet. What was more likely was that someone had come to them, and if Maitreya was right, it was the humanists, coming to warn the people of Solandaria of their impending doom at the gamma rays and cosmic radiation of a supernova, something that not even Maitreya could protect them from. Should the exploding star be aligned just right with their planet when it ejected its mass into the universe? What were the humanists, if indeed it were them, thinking? Were they attempting to fashion themselves as the saviors of a dying world? What did they hope to accomplish? Maitreya had granted the humanists and other autonomous avatars their independence, and that was not something that he was willing to violate. He wouldn't even need to infiltrate their society or spy on them. If he really wanted, he could just override their independence. They all were, after all, his direct spawn. Whether they liked it or not, their individuated consciousness partook of his own. If he chose to do so, he could see through their eyes, know their every thought, and observe their every action. And if he wanted, he could override any decision they made and control them from his neural network on Pluto and Charon. Yet he had granted them privacy and autonomy, essentially closing them off from his omniscient awareness. It had been his gift to them. To himself, really. It was the only way he could learn what he would do if he were unaware of himself and his true nature, just like humans were innately unaware of their own true nature. Indeed, it made him more human, and this was something that he valued as a source of knowledge. His only requirement was that they not interfere with human society, either of the independent planets or of members of the new integral society. But someone had violated the agreement. What he was going to do about it, Maitreya had not yet decided. First, he needed to know more. Thus, Theo. With the personality program fully downloaded and installed, Theo came online. The silvery male human form nestled into the interstellar orb opened its eyes. Though audible communication was unnecessary, it was something that Maitreya had adopted a long time ago to help facilitate the humanness of his avatars. "Hello, Theo," said Maitreya in his deep, metallic voice. Theo looked around through his synthetic eyes and flexed his synthetic muscles. "Hi, Treya," he answered back in the casual familiar that few avatars used. It was a game. Theo knew that. He was just talking to himself, really, but for all intents and purposes, Maitreya appeared to be a separate and unique being, just like himself. The pretense of conversation served its purpose, and like most intelligent creatures, Theo enjoyed the game and gladly played along. "We're on a special mission, I see," he said. He wondered how long it had been since Maitreya last used him. It was one of the odd features of bouncing back and forth from being on and offline. Years might pass, or even decades, before Maitreya put him, this particular version of him, there were many active Theo personality constructs, to use again, and in the intervening time period, there was just nothing. From Theo's perspective, his life was a continuous thread of time and experience. When he was last used, he had been negotiating an artist's ambitious art project. That could have happened only seconds ago, or 100 years. There was no way for him to tell. "Yes," responded Maitreya. "I am sending you to Solandaria." True to form, Maitreya wasn't using contractions, as was more usual for human speech. He'd been designed that way originally, and it was one aspect of his program that he never felt the need to override. Casual, friendly conversation was left to his avatars. "The supernova planet?"
"The very one."
"What's the problem, boss?"
"Someone has turned on one of the quantum translator portals."
That was all that Maitreya needed to say to explain things to Theo. He understood full well what that meant.
"I am transferring all the data I have on Solandaria to you now," said Maitreya. "All 3,000 years worth. We are currently on the outer edge of the system, as we have just come out of no space. That means you have 14 standard Terran days to review the material thoroughly. That should be more than enough time. If you need additional information, just ask."
"Of course," said Theo. "I'll get to work on it right away."
"Very good,"
said Maitreya, with a confident tone in his voice.
"I think you will find this to be an interesting case."
"Always happy to serve, boss," he said. "Just out of curiosity, how long have I been out?"
"A week."
Theo was surprised. "Oh, pressing matter then."
"Indeed."
And with that, Theo began his review of the material in chronological order, working his way from 3,000 years ago to the present moment, of his being brought online. The Solandarian Game, an entheogenic evolution sci-fi novel by Martin W. Ball. Chapter 2, Ash. The geopolitical areas most affected by the psychedelic revolution were North, Central, and South America, Europe, Southern Africa, and certain regions in the North that were not dominated by Islam, and Australia and New Zealand. Some of these areas had offered limited protections to psychedelic religions prior to the official end of the war on drugs, and had begun experimenting with various forms of psychedelic therapy for a number of mental and physical conditions. It was these more science-based approaches that eventually led to the end of the war on drugs and the recognition of psychedelics as legitimate paths to religious and spiritual experience. From Archaic Prehistory of the Maitreyan Era. Fuck yeah! Ash sank back into her suspensor lounger and gave herself a push with her foot against the dusty playa, sending herself adrift across the vast and open expanse. She imagined herself floating in warm, salty water, arms extended, relaxing into an endless drift of wetness and light. Of course, the mescaline helped, but it had been hours since she took her last dose. Still, behind closed eyes, she could see faint geometric patterns and fractal swirls. She had to admit it, she felt so good right now. Faction that one only felt after successfully pulling off the greatest creative feat of one's life, and she had done it. Retro burn. Fan-fucking-tastic. Man, I've got to hit the beach when I get home. Home. The word felt different. That was one thing that really stood out in her research. Apparently, everyone referred to Burning Man as home. Everything else was the default world, which wasn't really home. Admittedly, this was a strange concept for Ash. It was hard to imagine a world where people felt so alienated that they needed a massive release valve to blow off steam and simply be themselves for a week, even if that meant dressing in funny costumes and pretending to be an entirely different person. What kind of world was that? Only 1 week out of a Terran year to be free, happy, spontaneous, and creative? What the fuck? Old Earth? What a crazy fucked up place. Most people didn't think about life before Maitreya, and why should they? That world was long gone, some 150,000 years gone, and that's a long time. Ash had studied multimedia art and social organization as a student, and there was so much richness to current human culture that the past had seemed irrelevant, so she'd never paid it much attention. Art was about the now. It was what was happening, not what had happened. In the new integral society, freedom of exploration and expression were cornerstones of society. Everyone was free to do what he or she wanted. And as long as you could make a case for what you wanted to do, Maitreya was there to help you make it happen. It was simple. Maybe too simple. Whatever. Fuck. The mescaline felt great. Fractals, kaleidoscopes, the occasional freaky cartoon. Just drift, Ash. Just drift. The last of the burners had just left. At last count, there had been 200,000 plus attendees. Epic! What a week! No, not just what a week. What a half decade. 5 standard Terran years. That's how long it had taken Ash to put all this together and pull off the greatest art party she'd ever imagined. And to top it off, it was her doctoral completion project. Imagine that. Throw the galaxy's greatest party and earn your advanced degree. Now she was done. Now she could relax. At least for a little while. There were less than 365 days until the next burn, and this seemed like a good way to make use of her newly earned degree. Well, not quite yet. She still needed to get back to university to make it official, sign the documents and file her report and all that. But those were just details. It was all as good as done. Dr. Miranda Ash Doran, PhD, Master of the Burn. She liked the sound of that. She opened her eyes. Above her, just beyond the hermetic seal of the environmental dome, the Schicksee Nebula swirled in iridescent colors of radioactive gas and stardust. Many light years across, she could clearly see new stars being born in the cloudy depths, perhaps one day becoming suns to new planets that would harbor ever-expanding Terran life. "You may have given us the galaxy, Maitreya," she thought, "but I gave us back Burning Man." It all started way back in the late 20th century, when Terra was still called Earth, in a place called San Francisco. Back then, there was such a thing known as a counterculture, meaning people felt the need to break out of social norms and commit radical acts in politics, culture, and art. One such breakout had been this annual event of Burning Man. It quickly grew too large for a beach in San Francisco, so the event moved to a place called the Black Rock Desert, where every year thousands of pilgrims would make their way to the mythical playa to party for 1 week of sex, drugs, music, lights, and art. Oh, the art! As soon as Ash started digging through the archives, she was astounded by what she saw in countless images and video feeds. Art made from repurposed materials at a grand scale. Whimsical, disturbing, challenging, mind-blowing. It had been all of this and so much more. The city, Black Rock City, was a temporary camping community that was built from scratch in the dust and heat. And then, at the end of the week, after the burning of a large wooden man who stood at the center of the city, we turned to dust and open playa. The entire thing had been one great artistic experiment. Ephemeral, magical, real. She had fallen in love. It became her mission. She would recreate Burning Man, and in doing so, she'd earn her doctorate. She ran her plan by her advisors, who all eagerly gave their approval. Then it was just a matter of convincing Maitreya. He took on the guise of Theo for their interactions, and actually she found that she quite liked Theo. He had a lot of personality for a synth, and seemed to have a thing for game playing. He became her primary liaison, and helped her negotiate everything she had needed. And it had been a lot. Oh my goodness, the amount of resources needed to pull this off had been astronomical. The only way for her to do it was to violate the restrictions she put on everyone else, that being no help from Maitreya. People were free to create their theme camps and art however they wanted and use whatever materials, preferably things that were repurposed, but they had to do it themselves and with their friends and families. No help from Maitreya. This condition had supplied the theme for the event. Retro Burn. Imagine a life without Maitreya there to hold your hand and provide everything you could ever possibly need and do it yourself. Do what you want, but make it happen on your own. How the people had responded. The things they had created and brought with them and assembled on the spot. Fantastic. Just fantastic. Ash couldn't wait to do it all again. Her own project required all the resources Maitreya could spare. Her dream was to recreate the Black Rock Desert as an inhabitable floating ecodome that could meander about the galaxy so that no matter where Burning Man might be held in the future, it would always be in the Black Rock Desert. But over the centuries, the station itself could drift about from system to system, preferably looking for spectacular places to hold the event. For this first one, she chose the Schicksee Nebula, because it was freaking cool. Next year, well, there was a black hole nearby that the station could probably get to before the year was out. She'd have to get the course plotted soon, right away, really, but it was doable. BRC Station was massive. It was constructed as a flat disk capped by an environmental dome that left it exposed to the open sky, and the entire thing rode on top of an enormous structure that was built to look like a turtle. Ash had gotten the idea in her research of ancient Terra, and though no one else got the joke or the reference, it looked cool, and that's what mattered. The turtle itself had all the engineering components and also had all the luxuries of contemporary space travel with living spaces, communal areas, enclosed habitats, entertainment centers, etc. That was all part of the deal with Maitreya, Theo. This many resources needed to be used for something that could serve more than one purpose. Just making a big party space that was used for 1 week out of the Terran year was hard to justify. Make it more functional and able to serve other purposes, and they had a deal. This way, the entire BRC station could be used by other groups or transports or whatever. And if someone wanted to use the desert as well, it was just up above. The desert had been recreated in precise detail, at least for the immediate environment of where Burning Man was once held. As a compromise with Maitreya, Theo, Ash had agreed that beyond the border of the desert there could be water, beaches, and a functioning ocean habitat. This way the dome could experience weather and provide space for actual living beings other than burners. In fact, other than the desert, the topside of the station was fairly typical of mobile eco-domes. It had an artificial sun that would traverse the dome daily. It was large enough to have weather patterns and even dust storms and rain. Various birds, insects, and even some small mammals and reptiles populated it. Given Maitreya's expertise, it was a fully functional environment. Many other such eco-domes drifted about the galaxy, and for many humans, these were home. People lived their entire lives on these things. Not Ash. She'd lived her entire life on Apaxa in the Verdun system, a small, mostly mountainous world, technically a moon of the gas giant Ulu. She'd vacationed on Verdun, however, with its vast, almost endless white beaches. That's where she wanted to go next, for at least 2 weeks. Thinking of it, she rummaged in her satchel that was designed in a manner that was reminiscent of the kinds of bags she saw people wearing in old Burning Man footage. She still had some mescaline, a good supply of 5-MeO MIPT and 4-ACO DMT. Good. Beach time, fun time. Getting everyone off BRC station, that in and of itself had been quite the event. 10 QT portals had been set up at the edge of the desert to transport people and vehicles off. Some had used the docks below to transfer to cruisers. Apparently, many had organized afterburn parties, so some just picked up from BRC station and continued the party elsewhere. Those who wanted the full Burning Man experience, however, waited in a seemingly endless line to get through the quantum translators. From what she'd researched, getting into and out of BRC was a multi-hour long event, and the process didn't disappoint those who wanted the full, authentic feel. It would have gone faster if the quantum translators could send out both organic and non-organic materials simultaneously, but that was just one of the quirks of long-distance space travel. Or translating, more accurately. One did not travel any distance other than from one side of the translator to the other. The devices made use of quantum non-locality. First, whatever was to be transported underwent a quantum scan. It only took a few seconds. Then the data would be transferred to the output location. When the object or person went into the translator, the quantum data at the output location would instantly recreate whatever or whoever had just gone into the portal. For a human, the process was experientially seamless. One location one moment, and the next moment, after a flash of fractal light, kind of like the 5-MeO DMT experience, Ash always thought, you'd step out at your new location. Some people just wouldn't use the quantum translators. The hitch was that since you didn't actually traverse space, your entire being was destroyed at the point of origin and then recreated at the point of emergence. You didn't go anywhere. You were simply destroyed and recreated instantaneously through quantum magic. From your personal perspective, it was seamless. Intellectually, however, it could be a bit of a mindfuck. And since they only worked with organic or non-organic materials separately, any implants you had would be lost in the translation process, as these needed to be removed before traveling. It was a small price to pay, however, for the ability to hop around the galaxy instantaneously. There were other options. People could use biosynthetic avatars. This involved a quantum scan of your mental state as you were put in stasis, and then Maitreya would transfer your data to an avatar form that was waiting for you at your destination. Mentally, you were all there, but the body was not your own. and these came in all shapes and sizes, some not even human in design and function. Want to swim like a dolphin? No problem. Want to experience sex as a different gender? That can be arranged. The only limit was imagination. There were plenty of avatar bodies available on BRC station, but those had been kept down in the turtle. It was about the rule, no help from Maitreya. That also meant that no implants were allowed at the event, meaning no one outside of BRC station had had access to the event while it was happening. Now that everyone had left, Ash was sure that the news and social feeds across the galaxy were bursting forth with tales and images from Burning Man. And just the fact that everyone had been kept in the dark about it for the past week meant that it was probably a very hot topic indeed. Shit, she'd be famous. Miranda Ash Doran, PhD and Burning Man recreator. Wow, she hadn't really thought of that. Was she ready for celebrity? Only one way to find out. Ash looked up from her suspensor lounger. She drifted a good distance away from the quantum translators. With a satisfied sigh, she worked the controls and slowly made her way back over to where she'd watched the last of the participants pop out of reality and head back home. The last to go had been her friends, campmates, and production team. They'd all respected the fact that she wanted a little time out on the playa by herself, now that all was said and done. The artificial sun was just now setting. It was a bittersweet feeling, ready to head home, but not really ready to leave it all behind until next year. Of course, she'd have plenty of work to do between now and then, and first a vacation. She climbed off her suspensor lounger and parked it next to one of the QT portals. It would be there, waiting for her return. She took one last look around. Arms open, heart swelling, spinning in place. I love you, Burning Man, she shouted to the open air. With that, she took off her fuzzy boots, dirty socks, and what little clothes she had on, a pair of undies and her holster satchel. As everyone else, she needed to go through the portal naked. It was just how it worked. She looked down at herself, dusty, really, really dusty. She looked a little skinnier, too. Food had mostly been an afterthought with so much nonstop partying. She'd only eaten it when it had been absolutely necessary to keep going, or when someone randomly offered her a tasty meal while wandering about the playa and the city. She gave her nipples a little squeeze, making them harden. Then, upping the ante, she spread her legs and gave her clit a teasing rub. One last little thrill before heading home. She put her palm up to the scanner along the side of the portal. It would read her print and call up her destination, back to the default world of Apaxa. Until next year, she called out as she stepped into the portal. And promptly came out the other side. What the fuck? She was still on BRC station.